In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Our San Diego Comic-Con coverage wraps up with this panel, a spotlight panel on Catherine and Stuart Immonen. I was honored to host this panel focusing on their careers. From their beginnings in the late 80s, black and white independent scene in Toronto, we'll be talking about their first project, Playground, and subsequent comics for Vortex, Caliber, and Revolutionary Comics. They also go in-depth about their new graphic novel, Moving Pictures, from Top Shelf, which collects the entire story that was first presented as a weekly webcomic. Stuart discusses how he arrived at the style for the webcomic, which he could conform to without straying too far from his daily drawing style for books like Ultimate Spider-Man and New Avengers. We also hear about their next collaboration called Russian Olive to Red King. And you'll hear about Catherine's latest writing efforts, from the recent weekly five-part miniseries Heralds for Marvel, her Shamrock story in Girls Comics drawn by Colleen Coover, and callbacks to her work on Runaways with Sarah Pacelli and Hellcat with David LaFuente. Plus, Stuart will be talking about New Avengers and the possibility of more Next Wave from him and Warren Ellis. Today's episode is brought to you by the expert on everything from Edward David Gill, a novel that's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. Now, we're all into spy stuff if you're Word Balloon listeners, and this novel absolutely fits the bill. A young man is offered a six-figure job at Vector Systems and mistakenly is handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the technology called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno thriller. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or at the author's website, David Allen Gill's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. Make sure you check it out. It's The Expert on Everything, a novel from Edward David Gill. Good morning. Thank you very much for coming to this wonderful panel. My name is John Suntress. I do a podcast called Word Balloon, and it's my pleasure to be here today on this spotlight of Catherine and Stuart Immonen.
You can clap your
words. So, and please. Oh, that's all right. Not at all. So this is very exciting for me, and we've got a lot to cover, but before we get started, I'd like to introduce someone here from Comic-Con, Mr. Gary Sassaman, who has a great presentation that he would like to do. Here's Gary.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Stuart. Hi, Catherine. I'm very honored to have you here, a special guest this year. And my question to you, Stuart, is how long have you been professionally drawing comics?
I think my first paying job was in 1989. And that was for Revolutionary Comics. They were doing a series of unauthorized rock and roll biographies. And I had the pleasure and the notoriety to be on the Guns N' Roses.
The Guns N' Roses.
Actually, I'm trying to get them all myself.
I'm here today on behalf of Comic-Con to honor your over 20 years in the industry. So Comic-Con's Inkpot Award for Achievement in Comic Arts.
Yay! Fantastic. Look at that. Isn't that cool? Outstanding.
That's like a real pot of ink?
It is a real pot of ink. That's wonderful. That's like when George Carlin in one of his old 70s concerts got presented with the Grammy, like at the concert. So this is fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Well,
wow.
So yeah.
We just do the rest of the hour on this.
Absolutely. Yeah, really. Like a TLC. Yeah, how do you make that statue? That's very impressive, actually. No, you mentioned you mentioned Revolutionary Comics.
Yes.
And yes, Guns N' Roses. What were some of the other bands?
Two Live Crew.
Sweet.
Prince. Motorhead.
The Beatles.
Yes, The Beatles.
Cool.
Reprinted recently.
Now that's got to be worth something on eBay. That's cool.
I couldn't say.
Exactly. They reprinted it recently?
Yeah, I think just last year.
Wow.
So there was a... I mean, normally these issues would be single issues.
Sure, I remember, yeah.
But they had a year-long, 12-issue plan for the Beatles, so it was an ongoing story. There's a lot to tell. And then there were supplementary backup stories that happened at the end of each issue, and I did one of those.
Excellent. Now, when did the two of you get together?
Before Revolutionary Comics.
Yes, yes. Because, yes, the origin starts before this.
We met
about 2 weeks into our first year of university at York University in Toronto. I went on to graduate, and Stuart did not. He lasted about a year, and that was about it. So it's been, I can't believe it. Every time I talk to John, he makes me say things that I don't want to say.
Aw, I hope that.
And it's going to happen again. So that would have been 1986.
That's okay.
So it's been 24 years.
My God, well, you wear it well. Both of you wear it well. Isn't that great? Well, the reason why I asked too is because one of the first things you guys did together was back during that wonderful creative black and white era of the 80s, and there were so many interesting and very singular products coming out, and you guys were a part of that.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, Toronto in particular was one of the hotbeds of the independent black and white movement, and Vortex Comics was based there, Andromeda Publishing was based in Toronto, and they were... You know, Diamonds Competition in Canada.
Okay.
But they had international distribution as well. So it was very very local and very easy for us to approach a publisher like Vortex or do things ourselves, which is what we eventually ended up doing. You know, Chester Brown was doing his Yummy for Mini Comics at that time, and Seth was working on Mr. X for
Bill Martin.
For Vortex.
Team Otter, too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So there were all kinds of things going on, loads of other stuff as well. So it seemed very easy and very accessible for someone like me and Catherine, who had no experience in comics and no experience in distribution or any kind of aspect of the industry, just to go in with both feet. So this was 88. We... like I said, we just dove in, and we cobbled together this story called Playground, which you can describe if you care to. And we thought we'd do a number of issues of this comic, but in order to help us get distribution and seem more like a real company, we also solicited help from our friends to do an anthology book that would be published alongside.
That's all true. but there, you know, Playground was I always hate to describe it because it sounds like the most pretentious product ever. But yeah, it was a punk murder mystery, and I'm so sorry. What is it, 18? It's not my fault.
Come on, it was the time. It's
it was
cool.
Like, yeah, it was 1989. It's totally not
It's not
my
like
fault.
It was Acid Wash Jeans issue 1 or something like that. You know, it's okay.
Are you sure? The things that we're not telling you.
All right.
But like Stuart said, I mean, it was just, it seemed possible at the time. And I remember when you left school.
You had to bring that up again.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had no idea I went on to design for film and television for a number of years after I graduated. But when Stuart left
I wanted to make comics.
Yeah, and I didn't, and that was fine. I didn't have a... But I didn't have a problem with it, but I didn't even know what that meant, you know? Like, it was this completely abstract...
Didn't feel like thing. A full-time thing? Or
well, I didn't even know how that might happen.
Okay.
Like, what that would actually look like. And, you know, what that ended up looking like for many years was, you know, you went on to work for every possible small publisher, both extant and extinct now, for very little money, and, you know... No residuals and no rights, and that is not meant to sound like a complaint at all, because at the time you had a choice of, I mean, there was Caliber and there was Vortex and there was Revolutionary. Stuart did the never released unauthorized excuse me.
Oh, the
she's choked up even thinking about it, obviously. It's quite alright.
There was a company called Innovation that did Hero Alliance and some other things. I guess they had at one point they had the rights to do the comic adaptation of the film.
I don't think they had the rights.
Well, I'll come to that.
We're here. You're here. Don't worry.
The film of Stephen King's Lawnmower Man story.
Yes.
And Jeff Fahey and Pierce Brosnan.
Absolutely. Great movie.
So I
great CGI effects and everything. That's got to be an artist's dream.
I never saw it, and I never saw any promotion for it. I had to dig up my own reference on and these guys, and this is of course pre-internet.
Yes, so I was going
to
say, how
I
do you
had to buy 8x10 glossies at a film novelty store.
Wow.
So that was the way it was, and I had the script, and it was as far as I knew accurate to the movie, but I had no way of finding him. And I worked for a year on it, and then it turned out that the rights had expired, or they never existed, and they never did publish it.
Are they the ones that sent all the pornography? Remember that?
Should I actually assent to that?
Yeah, it was them, right? It was they sent all this reference material.
Reference material in air quotes.
For I guess the way they wanted the women models or something, and it was
that was for Heroine.
Right, and it was this huge packet of pornography, and so we had to call them and say, you know, please don't do that, because
you're not coming for. There are customs laws against that.
That's a good point. Well, yes, international law, absolutely.
And that was also at a time when there had been a number of big sting operations in Toronto. Omaha Cat Dancer was one of the big ones, and there were lawsuits, and also, Little Sisters, the lesbian bookstore, was also embroiled with American Customs at that time for similar materials. So it just, what a nightmare. Oh my God.
Well, beyond the stuff that you guys did together, Black and White, Catherine, when did your other comic writing, is it really like within the last few years? Or?
No, not really.
Yeah,
it's been ongoing for the last, since we've known each other. You wanted to make comics. Of your own at the same time that you were doing this work and wanted me to write something for you. My degree is in theater design. It's a heavily text-based discipline. Writing was always sort of an interest, so I said, okay. And we did this thing together, and then Caliber Press picked up Playground.
Okay.
Right, and did one more issue on top of the ones that we self-published. So in between then and now, there's just been a lot of small projects that have been slotted in between just the other work that I was doing, which has just sort of been one thing that follows on. I mean, it's all the jobs up till now for me, regardless of the medium, it's freelance work, right? So it's not anything that you ever apply for or get a job in a conventional way. It's just one project leads to another. So, I had done some Captain America work for Marvel, and also Mutant X when it was the TV show, and they released some books. And so there were those two things, and those were a couple of years apart. And then the Hellcat Marvel Comics Presents was relaunched, and so we did the Hellcat thing, which led to the Hellcat miniseries, which led to the, so that's just, that's what I don't mean to sound ungrateful. I am, thrilled, and I love Marvel, and they are, it's just, they're a terrific gang to work for. But it's just been sort of a rolling stone, and so, I'll do it as long as they keep asking.
Well, and, we just wrapped up Heralds.
That's right.
And that was a wonderful miniseries, and I really enjoyed it, kind of covered that. I always hate the whole glass ceiling and women in comics, because you bring it, and it seems that every editor and publisher that I know, gender isn't an issue. At least it's been my experience on the outside. And as long as you bring the writing or drawing, they want you. And your depth of characterization in everything you do, whether it is the five issues of Heralds or even that wonderful story in the 80-page Superman Giant of Lois and Clark. Did you guys see that? Because it really is. A lot of times, like you say, you get these freelance things, and they are little stories in an anthology or something. And I wasn't expecting it, and it absolutely knocked me out.
Oh,
it was so wonderful. It was Lois has, the flu. And it's this wonderful Lois and Clark story where Clark is doing everything he can to be a good guy and a husband. And I almost wonder if there was a dynamic there playing out in some way.
Well, Superman's not, you can talk about the big guy.
Yes, because of Stuart's history with Superman as well.
But I don't find him the most, most superheroes, for me anyways, the strength of those characters is not the superheroics, right? So the strength of Patsy Walker Hellcat is not Hellcat, it's Patsy Walker.
Certainly.
And I think part of the problem with Superman, for me, is because those two things, the Clark Kent and the Superman, they're awfully close together now. especially.
Sure.
But also, you know, he's invincible and he's kind of boring and, you know, he's not my favorite. So, except that he was my favorite in the serials, the old serials, when he was kind of a jerk, had like a really short attention span, was a, you know, he was mischievous, a bit of a child. You know, I love that iteration of Clark Kent, for sure. So that's what, I mean, in that story, Lois and Clark have separate beds, which was just sort of, and I know that some people looked at it and went, that's not the way he is. Just for now, you know, it's a proposition. It's just, let's just think about them like this for 8 pages. It won't kill you, you know, and let's just see what happens, right?
I remember when I was drawing Superman and Carl Kiesel was writing, it was always Carl's idea that Clark and Lois were like Nick and Nora Charles. So that they would, you know, be exchanging witty banter, and they'd be, you know, sort of, there'd be double entendres, and they'd be very sly together. You know, Nick and Nora would have a dream.
Right.
All the time.
And I agree with you. I think that the strength of the characters has everything not to do with the action sequences. I mean, they're what propels the story, and they get you from beginning to end, but what the meat of it inevitably is, you know, how these people interact with each other, what they, you know, what they mean to each other.
And then a very different dynamic as far as man and woman is played out in Moving Pictures, the top shelf book, but also the wonderful webcomic that they did. And Stuart, I should ask, because and I can appreciate from it being the webcomic project that it was, that your style of art obviously was simpler and very interesting compared to your, you know, work for DC and Marvel.
That other stuff, that pays the bill.
No, but yeah, you know, this like an Hergé kind of Tintin kind of feel to it.
Yeah, for sure. It was a bit of a challenge to try and pick a style that I could come back to intermittently while working on superhero.
How do you find the time to do that exactly?
Well, it's not just a matter of time, but consistency. Because if I'm drawing one way, you know, 5 or 6 days of the week, and then this is my sort of weekend project. Which, in a superhero style would not be appropriate for the story. How do I pick something that I can do once a week and, you know, get up to speed on immediately, and then, you know, get it online and get it posted, and then pick the next thing, the next page for the next session. So there were a number of iterations of what it was going to look like.
Good for radio.
No, that's okay. You got to serve both audiences. It's quite all right. Are they?
There were. I not only did a number of sketches to figure out what the characters would look like, you know, their body types and their clothing styles and settings and so on, but
and that's closer to kind of the next wavy kind of look and everything a bit.
Yeah, this was more naturalistic, and it was more sort of halfway between the where it ended up and what I was doing on mainstream books. But even this, I thought, might be more time consuming than it should be, just because we did have a schedule. If we were going to get it done once, one page every week, then it would still take almost 3 years to do.
Sure.
So there was a consistency aspect, but there was also time. You know, when we're publishing it online, then there's an expectation. It is a publishing schedule, right? So there are people that are waiting at the other end of it for that page to appear.
And it was the same day every week, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only way to really achieve success with a webcomic is to be there on time every week, absolutely.
Yes, yes. And we find that, to really be successful online, it's got to be more frequent than that. But this was the amount of time that we had to spare for this and still get it. So I really had to pare things down and in a matter of synchronicity, it really did suit the story much better to have a very stripped down style with, you know, no ambiguity to it whatsoever. Well, I've got some other examples I'll go through here if you... But I also wanted to show the scripts. The original script was not done in a conventional comic way.
Okay.
Where there are page breakdowns and panel descriptions, what happens in each key moment. So this was done more as a play or a movie script, screenplay. So we spent a lot of time, the collaboration time that we spent was not in the, you know, me looking over the Catherine as she typed the script or her checking on the art, but in the middle where we decide where the key moments should be and how much should be said in each panel. So you can see that these are heavily notated.
They look like, for my audio audience, it's kind of diagrams and sheets. It's almost like John Madden taking a pen out and you know, showing you exactly how the play just unfolded on a football play.
And a big coffee stain.
Well, that's good. That's the domestic collaboration. I think that's good.
At one point, in a matter of consistency, I felt that I was getting off base with drawing one of the main characters, Anna Gardner. I thought she started to look like the man with the yellow hat from Curious George. So, Captain Pierce making fun of me. But you can see in the top line of this script where there are a bunch of numbers and lines and breakdowns, but we decided that, you know, this one sentence is actually, it looks like one page, a whole page of description. And so that's fairly unconventional, but this is the kind of thing that we did throughout the three-year process.
Here
are some examples of stylistic changes. The top one was the second last version that I attempted. It's very close to the bottom tier, which is the final look of the strip. But even that I felt was too naturalistic and too soft and didn't really match well with the story. Examples, pencils and finished inks. And this is the way it looked like online, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
But it changed quite a lot, too. And, you know, when we first started talking to a couple of different publishers to see if anyone would even be interested in having this go to print, our main reason for wanting to do that was because we've published and distributed books ourselves, and it's a lot of work.
Sure.
And I didn't want to have to build one more goddamn cardboard box. Like, I really didn't. So we're trying to talk shop, and so that was really our you know, that was the impulse. We just wanted someone to take the grunt work off of our hands. And the only reason I'm telling you the story is because it just points out what, you know, complete idiots we are. Because the editorial process that we went through with Chris Soros at Top Shelf was incredible, and he made it a better book. So it's not substantially different than what was online, but it's, you know, refined and cared for in some different ways. And it was great to talk to someone who, when it takes you 3 years to do something and you're really only doing a page a week, you kind of, you know, you follow the small threads, but it can be very difficult to have, you know, sort of the big picture in mind. So to give it to him, who had never really seen this thing before, the input that he came back to us, with which he came back to us, was extraordinary, and it made it a much, much better book. So that's the reason you go to Top Shelf, you know.
You know, have you guys, show of hands, people, have you read moving pictures? It's outstanding for those who haven't, and truly seek it out at the Condes Top. I'm assuming Top Shelf has a booth.
Yeah.
So yeah, really go downstairs. And do you guys have signings there this weekend?
We do. Yeah.
Wonderful. And it's a bargain too. It's $14.95. Come on. And the wonderful thing about Chris is before he was publishing Top Shelf, he did the Staros Report pre-internet, and it was such an invaluable newsletter for comic fans to find interesting projects. So it doesn't surprise me that this is the kind of book that, you know, he would love. So by all means, check it out. It's a wonderful story. The backdrop is World War II and the contraband art that the Nazis were taking it, but that's just the backdrop, and it's a wonderful story, and I love the juxtaposition of the fine art and your recreations of the fine art while the storyline's going through. And that's, you know, just to even choose the art to kind of have that subtext of what's going on. Just really, it's such an interesting thing.
You can draw, right?
Well, and you can write. I mean, that's the thing. It truly, and you know, You always defer, but I got to tell you, honestly, you're both.
It's a beautiful thing.
And I know. And Stuart, I mean, I want to take a moment. And by the way, folks, if you have questions, we do want to have time for that. So please, if you want to prepare, you know, I guess there's not a microphone set up, but yeah, you know, if you don't mind doing a line, just so we can kind of gauge, you know, questions and stuff like that. So if you're leaner than
open. Do you want to talk about the rationale first? And
yeah, actually, yes. We'll just go through. So we're working on something new right now, so it'll be ready, I guess, 2035.
Will this be through Top Shelf as well? Or
this has no home.
Okay,
yet.
Okay.
That's certainly like possible.
Okay, and yeah, Russian Olive to Red King.
To Red King. So it's, you know, another tortured love story. I've heard from a couple of people who say, you know, that they're used to the funny from me, and then, but I would say that this stuff, which is, moving pictures, is best described as one long, strangled inhalation. It's like, I'm really selling this hard, right?
No, but there's a wonderful tension and dynamic between this woman and this officer and an interrogation that's going on. And then
you find out what's really going on between the pair of them. But it's really, I mean, maybe you can talk about this a little bit. To try and do a story where, you know, action in this context means that maybe somebody, you know, gets up. Or if they're feeling really crazy, they'll, like, you know, take off a jacket. Like, it's just this, you know, this, like, intense clench over 140 pages that's almost unbearable. That was the whole sort of intention.
I would love to see, and don't get me wrong, I this is a wonderful book, and Stuart's art's lovely, but I could see this easily being a two-person play. And I think it would play so well. And it reminded me of so many other tents, and forgive me, but it's a Comic-Con audience. That wonderful interrogation episode of Babylon 5 and this power struggle between these two characters that also is part of this very strained relationship that's going on in the story. And I don't want to tip it, but it's really great. And there's, you know, it's great. There's just a lot. There's a lot going on here. And it's such a wonderful, really dense read in a good way that you'll really sink into it like a good novel and a good graphic novel in this case, clearly.
But I think what you were hinting at was that it's so still. I mean, there's a lot going on in terms of the character interplay and in terms of, you know, the backstory and the layers that are being revealed as you go through. And usually we've heard from people that they get more out of it on the second read, which is gratifying.
Absolutely.
For me, there's so many still moments in the book that when an actual action has to take place, it was a bit of a challenge for me to figure out a way to draw it that wouldn't seem out of place. So we can't have, you know, Jack Kirby, you know, smashing through the fourth wall
big punches. Exactly.
Yeah, so there's one scene with the interrogator loses his cool and picks up a drinking glass full of water and smashes it on the table. And it seems like such a simple thing to describe, and yet it took me, I think, almost all week to try and figure out this sequence. I think normally in comics that would be one panel, but I ended up sort of drawing around the action because I couldn't bring myself to draw this, you know, thing actually happening, emotion lines, none of that. I couldn't do it. So I actually had to draw the few moments before, the hand in the air, still the rock, and then glass shattering as if it had happened just a few minutes before that. So it ended up taking a whole page, this one thing that in any other conventional comic would have just been a panel.
What do you want to tell us, and what can you tell us about the new story as it's coming out? Will you be presenting it first online again, or is this going to be a similar kind of project?
Well, that's the thing. One of the things that happened as far as my contribution to Moving Pictures went is that, as I described, I did one panel a week, and then I was doing other stuff. So when it was presented online, I don't think anybody minded too much if there were inconsistencies in the art. But once we had the idea that it was becoming concrete that it was going to be in book form and all these pages were going to be in close contact with each other, I began to really nitpick and look very carefully at the way the art looked from the beginning to the end. It was all done, of course, sequentially, because it was done, you know, piecemeal.
Sure.
One page every week for 140 weeks.
Wow.
That's normal.
No, hey.
I went through the whole book and I made changes almost on every page to make the beginning look more like the end and make the end look more like the beginning.
Because, okay.
You know, as I sort of got to know the characters and got to know what the contours are to follow when I'm drawing them, it became sort of like shorthand, and I was finding it much easier at the end, and it looked sort of less constructed than it did the beginning, so I tried to soften up the beginning to make it look like it had, it was a little less, like it was more effortless, and at the end I tried to give it a little bit more structure like it had at the beginning. So this one, in comparison, is just going to be pencils only for the entire creative process.
Okay.
And to avoid the problems that I had with the consistency of moving pictures at the end, I'm just going to ink everything on Russian olive at once, and hopefully it'll knit itself together in a way that the movie picture wasn't able to.
Very cool. And story-wise?
It's another love story that takes place along two parallel timelines. Red King, it's in an urban setting. He's trying to finish a project that's not going well. He's avoiding phone calls, and he doesn't really speak to anyone, but he talks to the dog. And all this at the same time that this is happening, his girlfriend, Russian Olive, has been in a plane crash in the northern bush. So he's, you know, trying to get this work done, all the while not knowing what's happened to her. And then it's her journey parallel to his at the same time. And the big sort of issue that really starts to come up is the question of whether or not she, in fact, did survive the plane crash becomes increasingly unclear.
Very cool.
So, you know, it's about Chekhov's tunnels that he was trying to dig to the northern island of Japan, and it's about petroglyphs, and it's about not being able to write, and it's about just, you know, not knowing what's happened to someone who's terribly important in your life. And so it's a barn burner.
Outstanding.
So I think it's going to be good.
When do you think you'll be debuting it?
You know.
So?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not your editor. Don't worry.
I will commit to 2035. And if it comes earlier, we're like Apple. We're ready.
When it's ready to the atmosphere, I expect a call, and we will we will go in depth.
Well, we certainly with Moving Pictures wanted to self-impose a deadline. So that it would get done, because Catherine had finished the script a number of years before I got up the speed to even begin drawing, and I always said, oh, you know, when I finish this project, I'll dive into it, or I'll do it in between things, and it never really happened. So once a number of people we knew were starting to do things online, it seemed like a really convenient way, if not easy, to make ourselves, force ourselves to find the time to do at least a page a week. But as I say, it still took 140 weeks, which, you know, seems impossible at the beginning, and it seems like it'll still never end once you're 120 weeks into it. That had a lot of things going for it, but as I say, I was unhappy with the overall consistency. You know, we're trying to stay on schedule with this, even though it doesn't have that sort of audience built into it where, you know, people are... It may just be, you know, a dozen people, or it may be 100 or 1,000 who are looking online every Friday or whatever to see the thing. You know, I think I've learned enough things. To be able to stick on schedule, you know, with my Marvel stuff, and still be able to maintain a schedule for this. It shouldn't take more than a couple of years.
No worries. All right. Well, I'm sure you all have questions, and I'd like to get questions started, so please.
John, it's great to see you after spending many hours listening to you.
You're very kind, sir. Thank you.
And I'll definitely go and check the moving pictures, but on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, I was wondering what are the plans for next wave?
What
are the plans for next wave?
Well, I'll say that this weekend is the closest I've ever been to Warren Ellis in person. And I haven't met him yet. So Warren, I, and our editor are all here. And I don't know if they've talked about it, but I and the editor have talked about it. And when the 12-issue hardcover collection came out last year, there was some talk about whether we could do a framing story or some kind of sequence that we could package with that. And Warren resisted it at first, so I hear, never having spoken to him. But then came up with something that he wanted to do, and I said I was on board, and then nothing ever came of it. So marketing didn't support it. Everybody who was involved with the book would die to go back onto it, but so far the budgetary concerns have not worked themselves out, and it's all having to do with numbers at this point.
It's that problem that seems to be unique to Marvel, where they've just got a number in mind. I don't know the number, and I'm sure it's well kept, but yeah, it's because it is. There are these wonderful, quirky things, and Next Wave was such an attention-getter of all these C-list characters, and it was clearly the creative process that made it the important book that it was. But, then it's time to make the donuts, and obviously they got, look at what Warren is writing, look what Stewart is drawing, look at the numbers they get on each of those projects, and you would certainly hope that there would still be time in the schedule for these kind of things to happen. We all want it.
Well, I remember
as a fan, we all want it, clearly.
Someone claimed that basically they couldn't afford to keep you on it because...
This was Warren, and the other half of that was that he said in the same paragraph that he'd happily work for a bottle of scotch. So whatever, it sounds good, but it's not true.
Maybe we need to.
It's everybody put together, and if sales do not support a book, it gets shelved. So there's nothing unique about that structure. It's just the way things are. So, I've got to be on books that can support that.
But the other good thing I would say, too, with anticipation, I mean, look how long we waited for Perez to do the JLA Avengers book, and then when it happened, no pressure, Stuart. But really, these things become kind
JLA
of...
JLA Avengers, next way.
No, but they do. They become these kind of hotly anticipated, we want to see a new one, and maybe that kind of momentum will eventually make this happen.
That's a beautiful theory, John.
Let's hope so. Sir.
Hello? I was wondering with moving pictures, how much research you did and what kind of research and how much you felt like you could rely on what people already know about World War II.
I'll start. I read a lot. The thing that started it was reading Janet Planner's Paris correspondence when she was the Paris correspondent during the war years for New Yorker.
New York Courier?
New Yorker magazine.
Oh, the New Yorker, excuse me, of course.
So that was really great, just great reading. And then there was like this little moment when she talked about cleaning the Louvre that just was interesting. It's there's tons of material available you can read until you die. But we did a really great panel about this exact thing in Toronto at TCAF, where we were talking about history and research. And one thing that we all sort of agreed on was the moment that you have to stop the research or stop using the research is when you find yourself wanting to include things that your parents, your characters, oh my God.
Wow.
There's so much.
There's a couch outside. We can set up a session later. Don't worry.
That's hilarious. There's so much I include that my parents just don't care about. But in this case, the things that your characters don't care about, just because you think it's really cool or really interesting, your characters don't have that kind of panoptic view that you do as the creator of the work. So I think you read and reread and you look and look, and the landscape for that period of time is so rich and richly trod, and at no point did either of us think that we had anything to contribute to anybody's understanding of what happened at that moment. But we had, we felt we had these characters to contribute in whatever context that was. And we just picked this one as a backdrop to sort of try and talk about a particular kind of relationship.
I'll ask quickly, though, Stuart, the new Avengers, new volume. I mean,
yes.
You know,
yes.
What? Any specific choices? I mean, obviously, this is a great story, and I look forward to your interpretation of how magic is changing in the Marvel Universe. That's how Bendis has described it to me.
That is definitely the way he was describing it to me, too. I mean, this was his impetus for bringing these particular characters together and starting off the storyline that the way he has. You know, I'm working in close collaboration with Wade von Grauwasser, who's inking, and Laura Martin, who's coloring. And we bounced a bunch of ideas off Ryan and the editor to try and keep things consistent within the context of the Marvel Universe as it exists. And Brian wants to have some nods to very early representations of magic, i.e., you know, Ditko,
sure,
even pre-64 stuff. So we're trying to include elements like that. And, you know, I'm just trying to draw the best that I can.
Well, it's
otherwise,
it's coming through, and I love the bits of magic business we saw in this week's issue.
I haven't seen the printed version.
I rushed because I knew it was coming out this week, and I knew I'd be seeing both of you. So I'm like, all right, I gotta be ready. And it's fantastic.
It's probably fresher in your mind than it is.
It's great, and it's wonderful seeing you drawing these characters that are part of the new team. It's great to see the Thing on the team, you know, Hellstorm and Doctor Strange. I'm always happy to see.
Yeah, what's great about Brian is that, you know, he'll see something that I'll have done in an offhand way and say, I really want to get all over that again, you know. So, you know, the Thing is on the team because Brian was really jazzed about the way that I was drawing that character in
fantastic
context.
Absolutely.
So, Doctor Strange, everybody was all over, you know, how I was doing the mustache. So,
Catherine got
an ongoing character in the book.
And Catherine got to play with the FF and Heralds, and that book is fantastic. When does the trade come out, or hardcover? Because I know
I don't know. They seem to follow really quickly on the heels.
Okay. Because
so soon, I guess.
If you hadn't picked up the weekly issues, it's a great story. It is an event in its own way, and it's a wonderful group of characters. And you get to revisit Patsy, but it's this wonderful story involving the new Nova and the creation of the character now. And like I said, the FF is in there. Photon is in there. I call her Photon. Emma Frost and Cyclops are in there, and She-Hulk. And it's great. It's really, and it keeps moving. And it's this really big event.
Thank you.
It's really great.
That was a gas.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. Please.
Catherine, about the Hellcat Mini.
Yeah.
I was really impressed by your version of Native Culture and
Thank you.
Oh, very cool.
So, where did you get the inspiration for all that?
That's what a great question. Patsy, the thing about Hellcat is that she doesn't actually have any superpowers. Not really. I mean, there was a little bit of sort of psychic training that she did with Moon Dragon. I guess it didn't take. So, it's a big problem with her. But because she's sort of, you know, been dead, been to hell and back, has this relationship with Damon Hellstrom, there's like this sort of magic-based component to what she does. I'm not really sure what it has to do with her exactly, but it's always kind of been present in the stories since she has been both avenging and defending. So I needed to look for a place where she could go where magic would be present. So that was it. So I just sort of started to look at, you know, where are places where shamanic magic or whatever is still kind of extant, or is a, you know, present concern, or is having an influence in a day-to-day way that in a lot of ways is not very magical at all. It's just sort of folded into a kind of worldview. So, and because it was associated with the initiative, you know, we had to, you know, so I guess that was not going to be, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, probably. So Alaska seemed ripe for the picking, and I love the population to geography, you know, people per acre ratio was very good. And it just seemed like the most ridiculous idea that they thought that it would be okay to just send her, and somehow that would be sufficient. And I guess it was. So, but that's what it was. It was trying to find something where there was a magic base that, you know, could be traded on. for sure.
And Patsy seems to be that constant thread through a lot of your recent Marvel work, because and that's awesome. Well, I know, and we discussed it in our first Word Balloon interview. It was wonderful to see her too in the Shamrock story, and again, wonderful cameo, or not cameos, because they really were all players in the story, in Girl Comics issue 2. I thought that was really terrific to see. And again, you pack so much character in like 11 pages.
Yeah, it wasn't very much.
Yeah,
Shamrock 2.
Yeah, exactly. And awesome. She's like, yeah, hey, you're getting
everybody's
Shamrock.
Favorite.
Oh, my, listen, I got the call to do that, and they said, it can be any character you want, but we really like it to be Shamrock. And I had no idea who that was, and then she described it to me. I'm like, really? She's a hairdresser?
But you,
really?
You, well, right now I would say you have the definitive Shamrock story. It's great, though. It truly is great. It's a great empowering story, and it's, again, it's not what it needs to be on the surface, but it manages to have good action and wonderful characterization of a good number of Marvel women. It's great. And Colleen Coover drew it.
Yeah.
And Lauren Sankovic was the editor on Girl Comics and stuff. It's fantastic, and these are one of the good stories. Did you have one more question, sir? We're near the end, so if there is anybody else for a quick question after this gentleman.
Catherine, I was just wondering, do you have any information you can share about the state of Runaways?
Indeed.
I wish I did. I don't. Anything that I have to say about the Runaways is just sort of my general feeling about where this is at. It's not based on any... I'm just gonna caveat until we're done, right? It's not based on any actual information. When I took over Runaways, it was the last four issues that were already on the schedule. I did the best that I could to sort of make it as irresistible as possible for them to keep on with that book. I failed. I'm sorry.
Well, not from a creative standpoint,
yeah,
I would say, clearly.
You know, but it didn't happen, and you know, my expectation was not that we were going to be able to pull that off, because it was already on the bubble.
Sarah Pichelli drawing, correct?
Sarah Pichelli, yeah.
The Pichelli, okay.
Yeah. Right.
And I know, shame on me. LaFuente did the covers, exactly.
Yeah, so that was great. We're hoping, you know, that there's been rumblings about the movie forever and a day.
I would think with Marvel TV as well, that's got to
be... wouldn't that be awesome?
That's got to be. And, I mean, I've talked to Loeb, and of course he won't commit to anything. I know announcements are going to be made. I don't think any live-action announcements, but come on, that thing's made for TV. Give me
I hope the movie does go ahead, and I hope that's sort of the thing that we'll get those characters back on the schedule. I think they're having... they're just trying to figure out what those characters mean to them and where they sort of fit within, you know, the Marvel Universe. You know, my preference, of course, would be that they don't fit at all within the Marvel Universe. But that's, you know, that's a strength of the characters, but that's not a strength for the book. So, you know, hopefully they'll work it out. But I'm hoping.
Something, anything in the, as again, because of the life of a freelancer, anything in the immediate future? You just wrapped up Heralds and the Girl Comics issue?
Yeah, three things. Right,
still
now,
not being announced yet.
None of it's announced.
Okay, no worries. But it's in the pipeline.
But it's a one shot.
Oh, when's
like,
when is this?
I can't tell you.
Okay. You'd have to kill me.
So irritating.
No worries. Yay though. More Hellcat. Fantastic.
More Hellcat. Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah. With possibly the most perfect co-star for her ever.
There's going to be a great Hellcat collection coming shortly because of this body of work that you're creating for,
right.
So that's wonderful.
I'm single-handedly trying to get her to take over everything.
It's
we'll see how that goes.
Always a pleasure seeing it back in Stuart, of course, on New Avengers.
That's right. Yeah, New Avengers and Russian Olive for just about all I can juggle with this.
Understood.
Point.
That's great. Well, continued success, guys, because it's always a pleasure to read and observe the art, and it's always great. Really, go to the Top Shelf booth, pick up Moving Pictures. It's a wonderful collection, and they are the sweetest people, and they've always been incredibly kind to me. And I'm so happy to finally have the opportunity to have Stuart on tape, and hopefully this will have broken the ice, and he'll come on the phone, and we can talk even more. We didn't talk about Spider-Man. We barely talked about the DC stuff, and you're always a pleasure, and thank you so much.
John.
And thank you for asking me to moderate.
Oh,
and Stuart, thank you for putting me in Ultimate Spider-Man as Principal Suntress, which was ridiculously nice. So thank you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Great insights from Catherine and Stuart Immonen. I was really pleased to be involved with that panel, and I enjoyed presenting it to you today. A final thought about the San Diego Comic-Con. I've been reading a lot of blogs and hearing some podcasts from people complaining about the encroachment of television and film at San Diego Comic-Con, and boo-hoo, it's not a comic book convention anymore. Bullshit. It's just not true, folks. If you were there, I understand that the lines get longer and everything that happens in Hall H slows things down a bit. But the point is, if you're going for comics at Comic-Con, you will not be disappointed. You'll have a great time. See excellent panels that only happen at Comic-Con. I'm talking about panels on comic strips, comic book history, firsthand accounts from Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and modern creators, all having spotlight panels, including things like the Inhumans panel. The independents were well represented. Digital comics and web comics both represented. 8 hours of non-competing panels on Friday if you were a comics retailer. Of course, the Eisners, which goes on for hours. And I'm not even including the television, animation, or movie tie-ins. You want to learn about Frank Frazetta, Al Williamson, Bill Everett, Jack Kirby, the history of DC Comics over 75 years? It was all happening at Comic-Con, and it was right there alongside all of the television, all of the film, and all of the animation panels. Comic-Con is whatever the attendee wants to make it. Don't take my word for it. Get there yourself and experience Comic-Con. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress reminding you that today's episode was brought to you by The Expert on Everything, a great novel from Edward David Gill. It's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. A young man is offered a 6-figure job at Vector Systems and is mistakenly handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the technology itself called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno thriller. Check it out for yourself. Purchase the book at Amazon.com or at Edward David Gill's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. It's The Expert on Everything, a novel from Edward David Gill. John Suntress saying thanks again for listening. Reminding you, the Word Balloon is all over the internet. Check us out at iTunes. We are usually there every Tuesday at iFanboy.com. This week we're a little late, and my apologies. But, of course, we're at WordBalloon.com. Come and check out our archive of well over 300 interviews with great comic creators. Questions or comments about the show, you can reach me directly via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Facebook under my name, John Suntress, or on Twitter under my handle, John Word Balloon. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.